and faith from the LDS tradition. And my role today is the role of psychologist and scientist, if I can use the term, trying to understand the process by which the mental, psychological, cognitive processes by which we come to faith and belief. I will begin with a Chinese parable, which goes as follows. A man whose axe was missing suspected his neighbor's son. The boy walked like a thief, looked like a thief, and spoke like a thief. But the man found his axe while he was digging in the valley, and the next time he saw his neighbor's son, the boy walked, looked, and spoke like any other child. While walking through the University of Utah Union, the sign on the bulletin board jumped out at me, holding my attention just as it was designed to do. And here's what it said. For women only, larger breasts through positive relaxation method. You can have fuller, lovelier breasts in just 4 weeks. A proven alternative to expensive, painful cosmetic surgical procedures, taught by certified instructors. You deserve to have the figure you want. Classes now forming. Only $75 covers the entire cost of the program. We accept Visa and MasterCard. You can have a more beautiful bust line without surgery. This method works. And then at the bottom it said, please contact Faith at the blank clinic, which I will not name. I was curious that her name turned out to be Faith. This was a curious and in some ways disconcerting experience. My curiosity was aroused, however, and I wanted to call and talk to Faith and ask her about the program. I realized, though, that I didn't meet the preconditions, so I could not attend. I wondered, could someone relax her way to a larger bust line at home? And again, I wondered if paying more than the $75 would result in more successful accomplishment. This announcement, posted by Faith in the student union, however humorous or ridiculous it may have been to you or me, was, I am sure, read by many people, many women in this case, and maybe some men, concerned with their bodily image. I am also quite sure that women called the number, and maybe some paid their fee, and maybe even some relaxed their way through the program. And finally, I am sure that some women, undoubtedly a small number, depending in part how badly they wanted to succeed, actually found success. While this may sound far-fetched to you or even impossible, let me in fact assure you that the relationship between what we hope for and what we get is a positive one. From false pregnancies to the stigmata, people are able to hope for something and occasionally get it. In some societies, even hoping for death works. The Jewish proverb tells us that we believe easily what we hope for earnestly. The more intense our belief, the more clearly and dramatically comes the answer. In this paper, I would like to explore the psychological relationships between our inner hopes and desires and our interactions with an external reality. This reality providing us with answers and confirmations to our questions and our hopes. First, let me give you a brief historical account from our Western history. The events leading up to the Battle of Wounded Knee in South Dakota on the reservation. In the decades of the 1880s, the tribes of Indians in this country were under great pressure. There was a Dawes General Allotment Act of 1887, which in fact reduced by great measure the amount of territory given over to the reservation. In the words of one of the Indian chiefs, they made us many promises, referring to the white men, more than I can remember, but they never kept but one. They promised to take our land, and then they took it. The Teton Sioux, having seen their lands reduced by more than half, having been forced to move on smaller and more scattered reservations, ended the decade of the 1880s depressed and despairing and drained of hope for improvement. The old values, the old verities, the old ways, the old institutions fell irrevocably, and nothing solid or satisfying took their place. In the spring of 1890, a prophet arose among the Indian nations in Nevada. This prophet offered hope for the Indian, hope not dependent upon the promises of the white man. This new prophet offered a vision of paradise where all things returned to the way they were before the domination of the whites, where all Indians would be free of the white burden, residing in a land without white people, bounteous in game and all the other riches cherished by the Indians, a land free of sickness and drought, where all people dwelt in peace with one another. Influenced, no doubt, by Christian teachings, this Indian leader became known as the Messiah. Quotes, "And when pilgrims from reservations all over the West gathered at his brush lodge, he showed them the scars on his hands where centuries before the whites had nailed him to the cross." His promise of this Indian Eden could be attained only by practicing the tenets of this new faith and dancing the sacred and prescribed ghost dance. Should the Ogallala Sioux and the Teton Sioux take this seriously? Was it too much to hope? If true, said Red Cloud, one of the leaders, it would spread all over the world. If false, he said, it would melt like the snow under the sun. Little Wound agreed, but spoke for most of the chiefs in the South Dakota reservation. In urging them not to take a chance, "You better learn this dance," he warned, "so if the Messiah does come, he will not pass us by." And learn the dance they did. All across the South Dakota reservation, the people pitched their teepees in the cottonwood groves and danced. Quotes, "Hypnotically, in slow shuffling cadence, they danced around the sacred prayer trees. And as the intensity and excitement mounted, some fell to the ground to die and go to heaven, and there talk with the Indian Messiah and see the beautiful new world. They came back to describe their experiences and to urge others to dance with a passion that would reveal to them, too, a vision of the promised land." Unhappily, among the Ogallala Sioux, the meaning of the dance shifted away from the nonviolence taught by the prophet in Nevada to the suggestion that some of the direct action was better to bring about the celestial kingdom. The special ghost shirts appeared and were worn by the Indians in their dances. "These shirts would turn away the white man's bullets," said the priests. The Teton Sioux and the Ogallala Sioux, believing easily for what they so desperately hoped, donned their ghost shirts and danced the ghost dance with increasing defiance and rebellion until the tragedy of Wounded Knee ended the dream. For the Sioux, as Robert Utley comments, despite a decade of reservation experience, the loss of their freedom and traditional way of life seemed unthinkable until the bullets of the 7th Cavalry penetrated their ghost shirts and shattered the dream held out by the Indian Messiah. Here is a comment from a government ethnologist in 1892 as he wrote about the ghost dances. "When the race lies crushed and groaning under an alien yoke, how natural is it the dream of a redeemer, an Arthur, who shall return from exile or awake from some long sleep, to drive out the usurper and win back for this people what they have lost. The hope becomes a faith, and the faith becomes the need for priests and prophets, until the hero is a god and the dream is a religion, looking to some great miracle of nature for its culmination and accomplishment." How is it, then, that some are able to believe easily and maintain this belief, while others cannot and do not? What happens when someone is converted to a religion or a political ideology while his neighbor has no interest? Obviously, these questions are complicated and probably have no single reliable answer. In this paper, I will review the psychological and sociological evidence very briefly that bears on these questions and has this premise as its primary focus. We believe easily what we hope for earnestly. That is, in order to believe in a doctrine or philosophy, a necessary precondition is that one must hope to believe. One must actively seek in order to find. Not only is this active hoping and seeking necessary, it is probably a natural and automatic psychological behavior, especially when confronted with ambiguity, uncertainty, and confusion. Hope comes before faith and prepares the way. Hope makes it possible to find those confirmations or experiences that lead to faith. What we hope for earnestly comes to pass. When it comes to pass, it supports powerfully our belief in those agents that seem to have caused that to happen in which we hoped. Even when what we hope for does not come to pass, we can often redefine the situation so that our belief system remains intact. Perhaps our most common shared experience, ours, is that we experience the world through our senses. Nevertheless, it is now clear we do not experience the same world. Rather, we construct a pattern or an order that makes sense to us in the framework of our previous experience. This is what the psychologists call the assumptive world, the world of previously held assumptions or beliefs that serve to screen and define what we will in fact continue to experience. In order to be able to function in a confusing, ambiguous, and essentially, quotes, meaningless world, meaningless, that is, until some level of order appears, we of necessity must impose an order upon what William James calls the booming, buzzing world. The fact is, of course, that the beginnings of that order are usually willed to us by those significant others who surround us from our earliest moments. Out of these experiences, we develop a set of more or less permanent, implicit assumptions about ourselves and the nature of the world we live in. Once in place, this assumptive worldview, which functions as a filter or a screen, serves to let certain perceptions in and keep others out, to define and direct our attention, our awareness, and our interest, and above all, to help us make sense out of what's happening to us. As the noted anthropologist Mary Douglas notes, anything whatsoever that is perceived at all must pass through our perceptual control. In the sifting process, something is admitted, something is rejected, and something supplemented to make the event recognizable. The process is largely cultural. A cultural bias puts moral problems under a particular light. Once shaped, the individual choices come cataloged according to the structuring of consciousness, which in no way is a private affair. That this process works is illustrated by the rather simple-minded findings of an early research project into this process. Frank reports that when using a stereopticon, a device that allows the presentation of two different pictures simultaneously to each eye, or one to each eye, a picture of a baseball player when shown to one eye and that of a bullfighter to the other. Americans tend to see the baseball player. Mexicans tend to see the bullfighter. During the past decades, cognitive psychology has come to define this assumptive world in terms of structures, schema, paradigms, ideologies. A useful metaphor that I would like to use is the one of the cognitive map, that is, a map created, which we consult when we want to figure out where we are and where we're going. This map, in order to make sense of the world, functions in the mind, or maybe is the mind, to reduce ambiguity to a comfortable level, to gain some control over the future, to develop additional maps of reality based on previous experience, and especially to conform to social norms and values. In the words of Michael McCloskey, mapping is affected by the mind's very active interpretive quality. Our cognitive facilities operate ahead of our conscious awareness, sorting through a wealth of potential information. Our mental processes make rapid estimates of what is valuable to notice and what can be treated as background. The mind takes fragments and makes something that fits existing organized schemes. In the phrase of Norwood Russell Hansen, there is more to seeing than meets the eyeball. Everywhere we look, we see with theory-laden eyeballs. The process of seeing, that is, of making sense out of our experience, even though it seems simple to us. Einstein once remarked that it is the theory which decides what we can observe. The personal theory, that is the cognitive map, be it ideology or paradigm, this cognitive map developed over many years of being taught what to see and how to understand is a powerful lens through which we are required to focus. In many ways, because of our repeated use of the personal theory of order, reinforced and given meaning by the primary groups that nurture us, it becomes impossible to see otherwise. It all seems so natural and makes good sense. We don't see things as they are, remarks the writer Anais Nin. We see them as we are. The psychological theorist George Kelly discussed the ways we fit things into patterns in this way. Man looks at his work through transparent patterns or templates, which he creates and then attempts to fit over the realities of which the world is composed. The fit is not always very good, yet without such patterns, the world appears to be in such an indifferentiated homogeneity that man is unable to make any sense of it. Even a poor fit is more helpful than nothing at all. Studs Terkel, in writing his book, Working, comments on a lawyer observing a Picasso statue being unveiled in Chicago. The lawyer, after deep study, mused as follows. I accept Mr. Picasso in good faith, but if you look at the height of the slope on top and the propensity of children who will play on it, I have a feeling that some child may fall off and be hurt, and the county may be sued. Just as a lawyer is a lawyer when he's judging art, so we all are what we are when we observe, make sense, pass judgment, and draw conclusions. What we come to believe, and especially the way we come to believe, that is the process, is a central part of our worldview, our frame of reference. We are continually engaged in making hypotheses in order to understand and explain what is happening and predict what may happen in the future. Many of these explanations are given to us in the transfer of order, that is, the order of the universe from previous generations. Once we seize upon these conjectures or explanations, it becomes very difficult or maybe impossible to let them go completely. I'm going to paraphrase a research study I have here in some detail in the interest of time. These researchers would sit you down before a panel of lights, and these lights would be flashing on and off randomly, and you were to indicate by punching buttons what you think the pattern is, that is, a blue and then a red and then a yellow, or a yellow and then a green and then a red. And when you got the pattern right, you were reinforced with a buzzer. Now, unbeknownst to the subject, there was no pattern. It was absolutely random. And yet, some of the subjects were reinforced, told they were correct, and other subjects were told that they were not correct. So here you have people sitting before an absolutely random experience, punching out a code that they think makes sense, and a buzzer going on saying, you are right. Let me just comment what the researcher says about this. At this point, subjects are told the truth about the experimental setup, but they are first unable to believe it. Some even assume that the experimenter is the deluded one, that they have discovered a regularity in the functioning of the machine that the experimenter never noticed. Others have to be actually shown the wiring and the randomizing process of the apparatus before they believe in the non-contingent nature of the experiment. This relatively simple experiment faithfully reproduces the essence of a human problem, which is the essence of this paper. Once we have arrived at a solution, and in the process of getting there have paid a fairly high price in terms of anxiety and expectations, our investment in this solution becomes so great that we may prefer to distort reality to fit our solution rather than sacrifice the solution. What is the need we have to construct these realities, and what are the mechanisms? The hypothetical construct of mind has been used as an agent that acts to improve order, to impose order upon disorder. Steinbrenner, in an essay, summarizes the active constructive nature of this mind. The mind is an inference machine that actively imposes order on highly ambiguous situations. The mind works to keep internal core beliefs consistent and unchallenged. Signals that are contradictory, that do not fit, must be reworked, modified, distorted, denied, or ignored. The mind seeks and prefers unambiguous answers and simple conclusions. The mind prefers stable and enduring relationships among its core beliefs. And when faced with a challenge or dissonance, the mind will resolve the conflict almost always in favor of the previously held belief. McCloskey summarizes these principles as follows. The mind is an inference machine that strives mightily to bring order, simplicity, constancy, and stability to the world it encounters. When nature is ambiguous, people develop strong beliefs to reduce the level of ambiguity. In Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, Lewis Carroll creates a conversation between the king and the knave that goes like this. "Please, Your Majesty," said the knave, "I didn't write it, and they can't prove I did. There's no name signed at the end." "Aha," said the king, "if you didn't sign it, that only makes the matters worse. You must have meant some mischief, or else you would have signed your name like an honest man." In this insightful passage, Carroll presents the face of the true believer. No matter what is said, the king ends up believing what he believed from the beginning. And in this case, adding the burden of deceit to the list of the sins of the poor knave. For the religious person, this is a real dilemma. We walk balanced upon a psychological razor's edge. We must hope in order to arrive at belief and faith. Yet if we hope too earnestly for something, or in some cases for anything, we run the very real risk of grabbing onto whatever passes us by. Graham Greene, in his novel The End of the Affair, describes such a person as he describes the heroine Sarah. "I believe there's a God," she says. "I believe the whole bag of tricks. There's nothing I don't believe. They could subdivide the Trinity into a dozen parts and I'd believe. They could dig up records that prove Christ had just been invented by Pilate and I'd believe just the same. I've caught belief like a disease. I've fallen into belief like I've fallen in love." Thus the psychological dilemma remains. We need to develop a belief system in order to define and understand the order of the world, and especially to act appropriately. If we need this belief primarily to feel safe and secure amid the ambiguity and chaos, we run the risk of falling into beliefs that are incorrect, or catching belief like a disease. In the Book of Mormon, Alma, in chapter 32, verse 21, presents us with this scripture. "And now, as I have said concerning faith, faith is not to have a perfect knowledge of things. Therefore, if ye have faith, ye hope for things which are not seen, which are true." There seem to me to be two important issues raised in this scripture related to this presentation. First, when ye have faith, or in the process of acquiring faith, ye hope for things which are not seen. That is, faith is connected in time to hope. And secondly, we hope for those unseen things, quotes, which are true. Thus, we need to have hope in order to have faith, and most critically of all, we should put our faith in those things which are true. But how to know which are those things that are true is the central issue. Since people will end up believing something, which may not necessarily fit into a more objective definition of truth. Modern psychological insight into an individual's defensive strategies have elaborated and illuminated this problem. Ernst Baier, a colleague at the university, argues that we are masters of subtle self-coercion and self-deceit in the interest of our powerful needs. He goes on, anyone who listens to another through the filter of his own hopes and fears will always seize upon those fragments of the speaker's thought and feeling that confirm his own expectations. That is, he will be listening to his own echo. Is there anything to this view of humankind? As a matter of fact, the psychological evidence that we distort our world in order to improve its fit is very impressive. For example, and I'm going to list a whole series of findings that come out of the research, people manage knowledge or facts in a variety of ways to promote and confirm judgments already held. People tend to reject messages contrary to their prior opinions while accepting messages that reinforce the existing opinions. For example, in a study of ESP, two psychologists, Russell and Jones, gave to believers and skeptics information about ESP and asked them to read it. Some of the information disproved and some of the information proved the existence of ESP. The believers remembered the confirming experience material 100% of the time, but they remembered the negative materials only 30% of the time. Whereas the skeptics, who didn't believe in ESP, remembered both kinds of information about 90% of the time. This dominance of our previously held opinion is called a cognitive bias. This bias not only selects information from our memory that supports our present set of beliefs, but also contributes actively in the construction of new arguments necessary to refute new or contradictory arguments or facts. One of the best established recent findings in social psychology is that people perceive themselves readily as the origins of good effects and hardly at all or reluctantly as the origins of ill effects. We are quick to take credit for success. We rapidly and skillfully deny responsibility for failure. In group efforts, individuals consistently accept more responsibility for the outcome, especially if it's successful, than other participants attribute to them. And then there's the matter of memory. A poet by the name of William Matthews gives us this couplet. There's no truth about your childhood, though there's a story. Yours to tend like a fire or a garden. Make it a good one, since you'll have to live it out and all its revisions so long as you shall live. Is our memory, in fact, a story that we must tend like a fire or a garden? As a matter of fact, it turns out to be so. There is, I think, from my point of view, almost irrefutable evidence that we, in fact, reconstruct the past, reshape it, in our own interest to meet our own needs. And finally, two more bits of information, or not bits, but bodies of information that relate directly, but I don't have any time at all to discuss. The well-known placebo effect. If you are given a sugar pill and told that it's medicine, and if a doctor doesn't know if it's medicine or not, and you want to get better, some rather amazing things happen. For example, here's a summary of research. When treated with a placebo, relief appears from coughing, mood changes occur, angina disappears, headaches disappear, seasickness disappears, anxiety, hypertension, asthma, depression, and a common cold are improved. Not only that, but physiological conditions change. Low blood sugar in diabetics is raised. Tumors are shrunk. Both the nausea, that is the feeling, and the stomach activity diminish. And not only that, but placebos create for us side effects, toxic side effects, just like real medicine. such as sleeplessness, palpitations, irritability, weaknesses, drops in blood pressure, itching, all from having taken a sugar pill and believing that we are being treated with medicine. The second body of information I will pass by, having to do with the well-known Pygmalion effect, and briefly let me summarize it by saying, particularly in education, when teachers expect students to perform in certain ways, that is, they're manipulated and told that they have on this side bright students and on this side dumb students, lo and behold, these students in fact do better. And lo and behold, these students in fact do worse when there is no discernible difference in ability. And that has been repeated over and over and over again, which raises some serious questions about the way we communicate to people about our expectation and how they act in response to our expectations. Summarizing, when we interpose ourselves, our egos, our wishes, our desires, our beliefs between events and facts and their meanings, the possibility of distortion is high. Especially when the issue at hand is crucial and intense, we have a stake in looking good, in feeling sure, in not being wrong. Apropos to the current political scene, I found in a book by Lenny Bruce his comments on a previous presidential election. And this was from one of his routines, nightclub routines. Suppose he said that one of the candidates would look into the camera during a presidential debate and say, "I am a thief, a crook. Do you hear me? I am the worst choice you could ever make for the presidency." And even then his followers would say, "Now there's an honest man for you." It takes a big guy to admit that. Now that's the kind of a guy we need for president. Once again, the central premise of this paper, the beginnings of faith is hope. The beginnings of belief, and also the beginnings of faith is hope, or a desire to believe, and a desire to have faith. Without a hopeful attitude, or a set, or a cognitive bias, if we can use psychological jargon, referred to this paper as a cognitive map, the necessary psychological preconditions for belief and faith are not present. With a hopeful attitude present, then belief can follow. We do, in fact, believe easily those things for which we hope earnestly. LDS scripture, in my opinion, seems to offer support. Two very brief scriptures from Moroni 8:40. "And again, my beloved brethren, I would speak to you concerning hope. How is it that ye can attain unto faith, save ye shall have hope?" And in Alma, the famous scripture of the comparison of faith to a seed. "But behold, if ye will awake and arouse your faculties, even to an experiment upon my words, and exercise a particle of faith, yea, even if this is no more than desire to believe, let this desire work in you until ye believe in a manner that ye can give a portion, that ye can give a portion of my words." The psychological relationship between hope and faith reflected in these words may lead me to a speculative position. Hoping for something creates a disequilibrium, a lack of balance, which increases our scanning and our searching and our selecting process. We want to find something to get us back into balance. Now it becomes important to find supporting facts or evidence that will both reduce the sense of disequilibrium, providing us with a sense of security and comfort, and reinforce the attitude of hoping. The facts or information that we select out must fit within our previously constructed cognitive realities, or else they will not be assimilated. In parentheses, I remember reading in a Midwestern newspaper, their motto, "Whatever news that fits, we print." For us, it may be, whatever fits, that is, fits our beliefs, we believe. While this process of hoping may create appropriate conditions for believing, it also creates a condition of risk where we may end up grasping or holding on to some belief only because we need to, and not because it is true. The process of hoping, presented here as the necessary precondition for belief, creates for us a difficult task. If we hope too earnestly or too powerfully, we may grasp at the first answer that appears, or we may retreat into a psychological rigidity that permits no growth or no learning. If we give up hoping, we may find ourselves psychologically alienated and distant, removed, and therefore necessarily increasingly skeptical. Those who desperately hope for peace will surely find it. Those who cannot rest without security will discover it. Those who refuse to begin to hope will never find it. That is faith. In a previous passage, I referred to the LDS scripture in Alma that teaches us, if ye have faith, ye hope for things which are not seen, which are true. Yet we have seen that time and time again it is possible, in some cases highly likely, to believe things that turn out not to be true. At any point in time, I personally have no reason to doubt the sincerity of those who hope earnestly and therefore believe easily, and later, when more facts are in or when new issues are presented, are found to be in error. The problem, of course, going back to the previous statement, is how can people know for sure that their beliefs are correct? And how can people give up those beliefs that no longer can be supported? Answering these questions in any complete way is not within the scope of this paper. Let me close, though, with four or five conclusions. These are mine. We cannot always trust our inner feelings or emotions. People regularly report, with apparent sincerity of belief, experiences, events, conclusions, and beliefs that later turn out to be distorted or simply false. Two, recognizing our cognitive biases, our maps. By doing this, we may be able to predict those areas of human experience that represent for us a particularly attractive detour. Knowing ourselves, while difficult, may be very useful in understanding those areas in which we may hope too intensely. Three, the concept of kairos, a Greek term, is one to be considered, that in our lives, moments arrive when we are particularly ready to change. The phenomenon of the instant and powerful conversion. That moment, we may be ready for change in beliefs and values, oftentimes for reasons quite disconnected to the experience we have. That is, we are ready to believe, and therefore we fall into belief. For the heuristic of representativeness, which is probably the most important, that our beliefs, our true ones, will be representative and therefore consistent with previous beliefs and worldviews, scriptures, religious teachings, messages from authorities, life patterns of valued others, etc. And five, the perspective of time provides us with an important assistance. If we can withstand the pressures of ambiguity and controversy and resist the temptation to jump simply because it makes us feel better, we have a better chance of slipping past our own psychological biases and needs and understanding them in the perspective of time. I should like to close with what I believe to be an optimistic affirmation of the process of hoping, leading to the possibility of belief, perhaps to be followed by faith. In order to believe in the Messiah, one must first hope for the Messiah. Those who do not hope for him will surely not believe in him when he comes. As Little Wound said in South Dakota 100 years ago, contemplating the mystery of the ghost dance, you better learn this dance, so if the Messiah does come, he will not pass us by. Given the nature of that hope, its persistence, its intensity, its energy, its connectedness to intense psychological needs and wants, conditions are created that make it possible for us to believe. There is no guarantee, however, that this belief will locate itself in what is true. Thus, it seems to me that the process of believing and gaining faith and knowledge, undoubtedly a cognitive process following the principles and laws of perception and learning, must be a dynamic and often examined quest. Thank you.
I think it is perhaps unfair to have a a psychologist with a similar academic background respond to this kind of a paper? Perhaps a CPA, an engineer, or a politician might do a greater justice in terms of their history, their perception of these principles. It's an honor to be on the same program with Joe and to comment briefly on the paper. Joe won't remember this, but we first came in touch with one another about 22 years ago when he was finishing his doctoral studies at the University of Minnesota and I was looking at that institution for my doctoral studies. And Joe very graciously took 2 days out of his life to show me around the university and the community. And the one thing I remember was my first exposure to a meatball sandwich. It was a marvelous sandwich. And in Salt Lake City, I'd never been exposed to that experience. And I've never forgotten that, Joe. And I don't advance that as a metaphor for your presentation. Do not advance it. I would like to respond briefly in a personal manner, if you will. Perhaps commenting initially on my background and responding as a psychologist, and also from my experience and perspective as a member of the church. I love what Joe presented. They are a remarkable conceptualization, typical of the superb psychologist that Joe is, because it is the goal of the psychologist, I believe, to understand. And one understands, I believe, by developing handles, if you will, developing these constructs that enable us to understand and hopefully to predict and have an impact upon individual, group, and societal behavior. I would say that probably the most important, the most profound impact upon my life, upon the way I think and believe and act, was the decision and the experiences I had following that decision to pursue graduate education in psychology. When I left Salt Lake City, I was young, naive, somewhat simplistic in my thinking. I was a Republican back then. And I don't know, I know I'm no longer young. I think I'm not as naive. And I guess I shouldn't make a political comment this time of year. The important thing for me was to learn this different way of viewing life, of viewing behavior. The understanding of things that Joe has referred to, of cognitive style, of cognitive set, the importance of perception, that frightening discovery that reality wasn't really what I had always thought it to be, that it was really a function of my behavioral history, the kind of reinforcements that I had gone through that I had not been aware of, but at any moment in time clearly determined my response. I remember the impact of the placebo effect, and then of working with individuals in a therapeutic context and discovering that their reality was not the same as my reality. But I wasn't always certain which was valid, you see. And I think my conclusion was that their reality is probably as valid as mine, and it's important to them. I came out of my graduate education a better Mormon. I think I understood what my testimony was about, what my commitment and what my membership in the church was about. And what that said to me was that it was going to be a process of constant change. And that was exciting. Very few absolutes for me from that point on. The excitement for me was the constant change, hopefully a positive development, hopefully a greater understanding of myself in relation to my fellow man. To be a psychologist and to be active in the church, I think, poses some conflicts. I remember telling people when I was in graduate school that I was pursuing a degree in psychology, and their typical response was, have you lost your testimony yet? Probably the greatest shock for me was to be called as a bishop shortly after we returned to Utah about 5 years ago. Now, I, of course, was told by the stake president that this was an inspired call, and he's a very successful businessman, and I didn't want to talk with him about operational definitions of inspired calls, but I accepted the call. And had a very profound 4-year experience as a bishop. Thought it would be interesting to be a bishop and to be a psychologist at the same time, to see what kind of impact I could have upon the lives of people. I would say that it was the finest experience that I have had or ever will have in the church, for the simple reason that you could do things, you could call individuals, you could change programs and see the impact of your decisions, hopefully inspired decisions. And that was fun and exciting and was a great opportunity for me to reconcile my professional philosophy, experience and background with my religious. What does a psychologist as a bishop do? I'm not sure the psychologist behaves differently than others, but this psychologist responded in perhaps somewhat different ways. Went against the direction of the stake president frequently, probably why I lasted just under 4 years as a bishop. But for example, the woman who comes into you and reports a transgression that took place 8-10 years earlier, a brief adulterous relationship, and talks about the agony that she has gone through, talks about her reality, talks about her perceptions of herself, and her feeling that she can never be whole again. The psychologist as bishop, I think, tries to work with that reality, tries to work with that self-concept, listens to the data, the tales of, on a daily basis almost, walking around the temple and knowing that I can never go in there again. And then saying to her, let's the two of us think and pray about it and come back together in a week. And then hopefully responding to my inner construct and my perception of reality, being in tune with the Spirit and saying, I believe that you have completed that process of repentance, that a court is not necessary, and that you need now to renew your recommend and go on with life. I'm not sure that that's peculiar to the psychologist, but for me, it was important. For me, I was responding from the kind of understandings that Joe has responded to. I know of the truth that Joe speaks of, that we hope earnestly, we believe perhaps too easily. And I know that what that has done to me, for me, and particularly from the therapeutic experience, what it has done for others. Joe has described for us an important set of principles, a cognitive map, if you will, that if applied and understood makes a difference. And I think the value of his paper and the value of these concepts are self-evident, but I'll say it again. If we acknowledge, if we recognize these principles, their impact on our lives, on our behavior, hopefully we will not make the mistakes that Joe refers to. The mistake of hoping earnestly, of believing too easily, and believing in truths that perhaps are not true. Truths that may mislead, may distort, and ultimately provide or lead us to unhappy lifestyles and experiences. It is my hope that we will think about these concepts, examine them in our own lives, and look at the implications that they have for us and for others around us. There are obviously a lot of questions that come out of this presentation. The impact of reinforcement upon our lives, the kind of things we choose to reinforce in the church, how we acquire values, how we see ourselves in the church, the nature of our activity, the way we respond to church leaders, the way we respond to our own inner voices. It's a delight to be here. I have learned from Joe, as I hope you have, and I think that the question should be fun. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Richard and Joe. We've all enjoyed that, I'm sure. Whatever news we've received today will, of course, print on our psyche, and I think that it's going to be interesting to see how we process that.